Thank you, Klaus. Now, my old friend Arnold Weishman is the next speaker. Arnold is a visiting scholar and research fellow at the Hoover Institution, positions that he has held since 1982. Many of you read his columns in the Washington Times or have seen his numerous books and articles. His most recent book is CNN's Cold War Documentary, Issues and Controversy. His title this morning is The Politics of Vengeance in American Foreign Policy. Arnold.
After listening to Klaus, I began to think of the story they tell of Machiavelli. As he lay dying, his confessor said to him, "Machiavelli, Machiavelli, you're dying. Repudiate now the devil." And with his last breath, Machiavelli forced himself up and said, "Father, this is no time to make enemies." Father Klaus, please. A decade ago, Samuel Huntington wrote, I quote, "It is my hypothesis that the fundamental source of conflict in the New World will not be primarily ideological or primarily economic. The great divisions among humankind and the dominating source of conflict will be cultural. The clash of civilizations will be the battle lines of the future," unquote. His words have been reified by Islamic terrorist events before and after 9/11, Istanbul, Bali, Moscow, Kenya, Casablanca, the latest being Madrid 3/11. Thus the theme of this panel, foreign policy, the next 40 years, necessarily includes a new actor on the world scene for whom the concept of foreign policy has no meaning, and yet is an actor who influences, not determines, the foreign policies of the leading nation states. An actor who cannot be appeased because his objective is total annihilation of the enemy himself, included. From his home in England, Sheikh Omar Bakri Mohammed said the other day in the New York Times, "It is foolish to fight people who want death. That is what they are looking for," unquote. Today, when we try to foresee foreign policy issues for the next 40 years, it is with the realization that we are living in an era which was best described under different circumstances by Otto von Bismarck in words that are even truer today than they were in 1890. I quote the Iron Chancellor, "We live in a wondrous time in which the strong is weak because of his moral scruples, and the weak grows strong because of his audacity," unquote. Webster's dictionary defines scruple as an ethical consideration or principle that inhibits action. Foreign policy in Bismarck's good old days was based on nation states negotiating with each other or confronting each other on the field of battle, and in all cases, there was a foreseeable end to hostilities. The armies were professional or conscript, and when the battle was over, everybody still standing went home after the inevitable rectification of borders, the phrase went. Whatever the casus belli, it was not a clash of civilizations. Today, there are no borders to be rectified because as far as the Al-Qaeda and its freelance terrorists are concerned, there are no national borders any more than there are nation states. There is no foreseeable end to hostilities because the war being waged against the West is not by nation states against each other, but by an enemy who, speaking in the name of Islam, has declared war on our civilization. The terrorist network, I call it the Bomintern, produces dramatic, sanguinary results. It has established three very important facts. First, its threats are credible. Second, it can project its destructive power where it pleases, in North America, Asia, Africa, Europe, East and West, into the heartland of the world superpower. Third, negotiation, as is customary among nation states, is impossible since there is no single entity with whom one can negotiate or who can speak for the Bomintern or ensure performance of a treaty. President Bush's 1992 report to Congress was titled National Security Strategy of the United States. In that report, he told us that in the past our enemies, quote, needed great armies and great industrial capabilities to endanger America, unquote. That is no longer true because, says President Bush, it's no longer true because shadowy networks of individuals can bring great chaos and suffering to our shores for less than it costs to purchase a single tank, unquote. Despite the Bomintern's successes, the fundamental political character of its targets do not change. They may temporarily change a country's foreign policy, as we've seen most recently in post-311 Spain, but Spain still remains a democracy. Despite years of IRA terrorism against Britain, it still remains a democracy. And despite 9/11, the U.S. remains a democracy. The democratic ethos is not affected. Thus, one can argue that even if the Bomintern is still functioning 40 years hence, as I believe it will be, the United States will still be the leading power in NATO, allied with Western Europe, as well as Russia, and an emerging China, no longer Marxist, but probably still Leninist. For the one thing we have learned in the past decade of Islamist terrorism is that the Bomintern can attempt to terrorize a population, but it cannot prevent the population from going about its daily tasks as it has from time immemorial. There will still be autonomous terrorist pods, but police actions will limit their activities. And even so, one suicidal terrorist will always get through. The next 40 years will see a greater emphasis and concern by the United States on three phenomena. The first will be on controlling the raising and transfer of funds across the terrorist network. Lord Robertson, the former head of NATO, recently described how, I'm quoting him, how easy it was to have $500,000 wired from a bank in Dubai for anonymous use in automatic teller machines in Florida and Maine, and how difficult it has been, even with the backing of UN resolutions and 150 nations, to find out who raised or sent those dollars. The control of the transfer of money is going to be very important, and we are not devoting enough resources in this country to tracking down the money transfers. Second, Europe's fundamental problem, as Neil Ferguson has written, is senescence. The 15 European Union countries will have to contend with the exponential growth of the Muslim population in Western Europe. By 2025, it is predicted that the Muslim population in France alone will approach one quarter. The minaret will compete with the cross. If this population cohort begins to vote as a solid bloc, then not only Western Europe, but the United States will have to contend with a new power center in the heart of the continent, one which will even threaten Russia with its still unsettled Chechnya problem. Third, the U.S. will concentrate even greater efforts to prevent proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, even if that emphasis means infuriating so-called allies like France, Pakistan, and enemies like North Korea. A quarter century ago, there arose with Soviet support an alliance of dictatorship, which I called the Radical Entente. It comprised Syria, Iran, Iraq, Libya, and North Korea. Their Cold War politics was containable by American foreign policy because it was still a world of nation states, and civilian populations were not held hostage. Even at the height of Cold War crises, the 1949 Berlin blockade, the 1956 Hungarian uprising, even the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, one could still board an airplane without being searched or having to remove one's shoes. People went about their business because civilians were exempt from random attack. The politics of vengeance had not yet made its appearance. However dangerous the Soviet Union appeared to Western societies, civilian populations were not at risk. A plane might be hijacked to Cuba, but it was a momentary distraction which affected airline schedules, but rarely endangered airline passengers. It was generally the act of a loner, nothing like the catastrophic 9/11 conspiracy. Americans could ignore such events because there weren't very many Lockerbie tragedies. There was a nation state, Libya. Behind Lockerbie, and American foreign policy could punish the perpetrator and did. But American foreign policy has no way of dealing with Al-Qaeda terrorism because there is no nation state involved. Since the defeat of the Taliban and the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the Bomintern is without headquarters, and its members usually operate within a nation state, which, while hostile to the terrorist ambitions, still affords them the constitutional protection of civil liberties. The foreign policy machine is unsuited to combating non-state terrorism. What it can provide and will provide in coming decades is everything from cooperation with allies to putting pressure on states which are doing little or nothing to prevent the Bomintern from functioning on their soil. But even with all the cooperation in the world, as I said earlier, one will always get through. For American foreign policy, the problem will be a decadent Europe, which was well described again by Neil Ferguson. I quote, "European politics is dominated by a kind of dance of death, as politicians and voters try desperately and vainly to prop up the moribund welfare states of the post-Second World War era, but above all, to prop up what remains of their traditional cultures," unquote. The European Union, the EU, is coming into being at a time when the economies of two major members of the EU, Germany and France, are in serious difficulties. Over the last decade, unemployment in the EU has been double what it has been in the United States. It may even come to pass that a Marshall Plan for the 21st century to rescue the declining economies of continental Europe may become necessary. To conclude, in the years ahead, American foreign policy will have concerns over the Islamization of Western Europe, principally in France. This Islamization will affect the quality and preparedness of our NATO alliance. The Israeli-Arab issue will remain an insoluble problem. Insoluble because there is no single political entity in the Arab world which can speak and negotiate for the Palestinians. Hamas, for example, has made it quite clear it will not accept any agreement or negotiations with Israel except an agreement which ends Israel as a nation state. Proliferation of weapons of mass destruction will remain a live issue not only for us, but also for China and South Korea as they consider the problem of nuclear weaponry in the hands of North Korea. Iran is another matter, but I think Iran's theocrats will think twice before they begin to shout nuclear threats from the minaret. One area that may become a problem for American foreign policy is Russia and its managed democracy, as President Putin calls it. Russia has no true rule of law. Under Putin, the secret police have staged a terrific comeback. Since 1994, 9 members of the country's parliament, the Duma, and 130 journalists have been murdered at the latest count, and arrests have been few and far between. Perhaps the real end of the world problem we face was expressed metaphorically and frighteningly in a novel by a little-known European writer named Italo Svevo. It was in a novel he wrote in 1925 called Zeno. And I want to quote a passage from that novel. "When all the poison gases of the war are exhausted, a man made like all other men of flesh and blood will, in the quiet of a room, invent an explosive of such potency that all the explosives in existence will seem like harmless toys beside it. And another man, made in his image and in the image of all the rest, but a little weaker than them, will steal that explosive and crawl to the center of the earth with it and place it just where he calculates it would have the maximum effect. There will be a tremendous explosion, but none will hear it, and the earth will return to its nebulous state and go wandering through the sky, free at last from parasites and disease. Good luck."